Hello, everyone. Welcome to a very special episode of Uncanny Treks. We are covering all 10 episodes of Batman Caped Crusader Season 1. It just dropped on Amazon Prime. And Matt, what does it mean since we're covering all 10 episodes? It
means that I watched 5 episodes of the show, right, Bob? Just 5 episodes.
Oh, you lazy SOB. You lazy SOB.
Not true. No, I watched all of them, Bob.
It means there'll be spoilers. It also means Matt has unhealthy viewing habits. Do you want to tell the good people, Matt?
Yeah, Bob, I originally thought we were only going to cover the first 5 episodes of this, but we actually decided to cover all 10, the whole season, and I binge...
That was always the plan. That was what we said last week. Don't be doing this revisionist.
Then I ended up binge watching all 10 episodes in one sitting. So I had a little bat mania yesterday.
It was like a soldier. Whereas I healthily spaced them out over 3 different days, more or less.
Yeah, Bob was able to deeply analyze each episode and all the small, subtle nuances of each character.
I feel like when you say that, you're setting us up for like false advertising. I'm Bob in Cascadia. That's Matt in the Southland. We're going to talk about all 10 episodes. That means spoilers. We're also assuming you watched all 10. Why would you listen to us if you hadn't? So we're not really going to give plot summaries. But as Matt has pointed out, we don't actually really even need to give plot summaries for this.
Honestly, it's just villain of the week, guys. And that's what I love about this show. There's one villain that Batman focuses on, usually wraps itself up by the end of the story. There was a two-parter at the end.
Just like Batman 77, Matt.
We'll
go through one by one, have some observations on each. I tried to spot as many little references as I can, but definitely some obvious ones eluded me. So we'll begin with episode 1, Treacherous Waters, or as Matt thinks of it, the Penguin episode. Or the Lady Penguin episode, even. My initial thought was I expected this to be a little more different from Batman the Animated Series, the Batman 92, than it actually was. But as soon as it started, I was, holy crap, this really is just X-Men 97 for Batman the Animated Series. But the only difference is they're not continuing the Batman the Animated Series story, right? They're doing a new story with a slightly different setting. But other than that, the feel of this show is very much Batman the Animated Series with some cursing and a little more sex, a little more violence.
Yeah, the look of it especially, man. It could be a prequel.
Very much so. Yeah, prequel would be an interesting way to think about it. And that is an interesting difference, is the Batman the Animated Series pretty much just treats Batman as a already somewhat established character, right?
Right.
Whereas this is clearly like Batman's first few cases, it's, as we'll talk about, it's taking a lot of plot elements from Batman Year One in particular.
In the original animated series, I think the first, he's up against Man-Bat, and he's already been established. The police officers all know him already. GCPD knows him. Doesn't Robin just show up in an episode at some point?
I think Robin just shows up, although I do think they eventually do a two-part Robin origin.
It's called Robin's Reckoning or something like that.
You're right that he just shows up here and there. Matt, so this has been a controversial show. Some people have understandable reservations about some parts of the show, and then a lot of it's racist crap or people who've actually never read a Batman comic who are confused. We'll talk about some of the controversy, and a lot of the controversy comes from there's character reimaginations. And Matt, I know the character reimagination you're really angry about is Barbara Gordon, because it's very important to you that she's a librarian and now she's a defense lawyer. What's going on there, Matt?
But I have seen several Earths where she works for the GCPD. Never seen her as a lawyer before, but I'm okay with it because, quite frankly, is librarian still a profession?
Yes, Matt, because public libraries still exist despite the fact that you want to end them like you want to end human socialize. I was a little surprised that Barbara was a lawyer, and that's a common theme. This is skipping ahead, but when we meet Lucius Fox in a few episodes, he's not a CEO or a scientist. He's just Bruce's lawyer, right? So that's the trope that this show goes for. It gives a way for them to tie Barbara Gordon a lot more into what her father's doing and a lot more into like the crime plots of the show, right?
You don't really need a librarian when you're fighting crime.
Maybe if they were going with her as Batgirl, it wouldn't matter if she were a librarian, but when you're mostly focusing on her just as herself, you need her tied into the action a little more. I did think that she hadn't been a lawyer before. But Matt, I was doing a little research last night. I watched a little Harley Quinn. I watched a little of the 1977 Batman cartoon, The New Adventures of Batman. And I was actually surprised. In the 77 cartoon, Barbara is like assistant district attorney. And so she's always in her father's office and she's always helping him with the investigation. And then, of course, she's also Batgirl in The New Adventures of Batman from 77. But I just thought it was interesting that actually there was precedent for her as a lawyer.
So she was the Rachel Dawes job?
She was the Rachel Dawes before Rachel Dawes, right?
Wow.
Yeah. And for those who don't know, Rachel Dawes is in the first two Christopher Nolan Batman movies. Is that right, Matt?
Yes, it's Bruce Wayne's love interest in Batman Begins and Harvey Dent's love interest in the second one.
Well, and then the other thing I wanted to say about the first episode, Matt, I really do like, and you've seen this in some versions of Harvey Dent, but I would say it's not the major portrayal of Harvey Dent. The major portrayal of Harvey Dent's, he's a great guy. His scarring that turns him into Two-Face is a tragedy. But they really play him very ambiguously and ambivalently in this show, because he's not Two-Face until the finale. But he's around, and sometimes he's played as a good guy with good intentions, but he's also played as a really sketchy, crooked prosecutor, right? He's really making some very ethically dubious decisions about what he's asking for in terms of sentences, who he prosecutes. We could just say he's a prosecutor, because all prosecutors are ethically dubious.
I've always preferred my Two-Face crooked, like well before the acid splash.
Matt, another character we've got Harvey Bullock's partner, Arnold Flass. Does that name ring a bell for you?
Yeah, he was in Year One. He was the big dude who beats up Gordon, had blonde hair. Also in Batman Begins, he's the guy that gets the falafel and then Bale flips him over and brings him up by his foot and does his Batman voice for the first time. Where are the drugs? That one.
I don't actually remember what happens to Flass in Year One, but he's usually not around after that, right? He's a crooked cop in Year One, and then he's gone. And then you're right, I've totally forgotten they used him in Batman Begins. That's funny. And then we have Bullock here, who, it's always nice to see Bullock. They portray Bullock as crooked as well, which I was a little ambivalent about, because I do like Bullock as a character, so I'm a little ambivalent about him being on the take. Did you have any thoughts on that?
This seems like a younger Bullock to me, and he's got the mustache. I like to think this is Bullock at the beginning of his career. Not quite sure if he's crooked or not. Reminded me a little bit of the one from Gotham.
We're definitely sure he's crooked. I mean, he's doing extrajudicial assassinations.
We know he's crooked now, but eventually he won't be crooked. He'll be the Bullock we all know and love.
Yeah, but can you come back from doing extrajudicial assassinations for Boss Thorne?
Like, yeah, you can.
I don't know, man. Two other things about that I would say. So I actually haven't read a lot of 70s and early 80s Batman comics, but I think in the late 70s, Bullock, when he first shows up, is portrayed as a crook. And it is a redemption arc of him becoming not crooked over the course of those comics. But those were a little bit before our time, and so I've never really read them. And so I think we just associate Bullock with the animated series, where he's like hard charging and anti-Batman, but he's not crooked, right?
Right.
The other thing to note is that so do you know who are two of the major writers of this series?
Ed Brubaker.
Ed Brubaker is the main one. And then Greg Rucka as well. And so those are two of my favorite Batman writers from the comics. And we'll talk about maybe more about their stuff in a minute. But I have noticed that I think both of them don't like Bullock. I remember in the early 2000s, they had Bullock be crooked and they wrote him out of the Batman comics for a while. So I think for whatever reason, Rucka and Brubaker aren't really fans.
All I remember him, he was always more of the lazy cop who would eat donuts and stuff. I think he got shot one time.
Was that the comics or the animated series, or maybe both?
I think it was the animated series, actually.
Matt, so the big reimagining controversy, it's not Harvey Dent and Harvey Bullock being crooked. It's not Barbara Gordon not being a librarian. It's a Lady Penguin who's a lounge singer and a crime boss. And a mother. She's got her sons, Ronnie and Aaron. What did you think about Lady Penguin?
Well, when I first saw Lady Penguin, Bob, I thought we might get a drag queen penguin who performs in the Iceberg Lounge.
The only time I saw Penguin in the promos, and I mostly tried to stay away from the promos But yeah. Either the only time I saw Lady Penguin, or at least remember seeing Lady Penguin, she was dressed in a very penguin manner and she was menacing Batman. And so I assumed that it was just a gender swap. I was a little intrigued when we go into the Iceberg Lounge, which, as you note later down in the notes, is like a ship, which is cool. We go into the Iceberg Lounge and she's a lounge singer. I was actually pretty surprised when that happened in the episode.
Yeah, the music number was like over the top a bit. The drag queen thing would have been way cooler had they gone that direction. Are her kids meant to be Trump's kids?
They're totally Eric and Don Jr.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, I will say I don't really like the design of Lady Penguin, and I'm not a huge fan of the idea. I don't oppose gender swaps and race swaps in general. You'd have to take it on a case-by-case basis and see how it goes. I don't particularly like this as a gender swap. It's really interesting that they led with a Lady Penguin, which almost feels like they're trying to filter out some fans who are just too immature to even deal with this. Even though I don't like Lady Penguin, Penguin, even though I love him, is one of the more boring Batman villains. And I do understand that they're trying to find something vital and something interesting about him, right? Or her, in this case.
I was surprised they led with this episode as well. They would have been better served had they gone with maybe the Catwoman episode to start with.
We'll get to it, but the Catwoman episode irritates me for similar reasons, yet different reasons. Yeah, but it is a little more fun. And then I did just want to note, too, that it is one thing that I find very interesting and I commend about the show is it's willing to have characters just be profoundly unattractive. Pennyworth, Jim Gordon, Lady Penguin, Lady Penguin's two Trump sons, they're all very ugly people.
Yeah, they put ugly people in the show, Bob. Lots of ugly people.
For ugly and unattractive people like us, Matt, it's very nice to have representation. Representation is so important.
Well, going back to the designs real quick, Bob, Alfred Pennyworth in this show, they went with the Golden Age design.
Oh, my God. So I really wish they hadn't done this. I don't actually care if Alfred is fat. But so many morons, so many sub-mental imbeciles online are, what's up with fat Alfred? What's up with body positivity in Alfred? He was fat in his first appearance, you idiot. I don't think he got skinny until, I might be wrong about this, but I don't think he gets skinny until the 60s when they cast that guy for Batman 66.
Alan Napier, yeah. The only reason I knew as a kid that there was a different design for Alfred because before the internet and we were reading
Zero Hour, maybe.
You got it. Zero Hour, Shadow of the Bat.
That was the major reason I knew. I think the other reason is I want to say in, you remember the greatest Batman stories
yeah.
ever told volumes we had, either in one of them, either there was a Fat Alfred story or there was at least a cover with Fat Alfred on it.
I think there was a cover. It was showing you the issue where he's like a detective or something. Or...
Yeah, well, there was a whole backup series, either I think in the 40s or the 50s, there were several backup stories with Fat Alfred as a detective solving mysteries on his own.
His first appearance.
He also had a bowler hat and a Cockney accent, which is funny. I might be getting details here slightly wrong, but a Cockney accent is more a working class London accent, at least certain working class neighborhoods of London. Whereas the Alfred, you know, we know and love from the Batman 66 show and from Batman the Animated Series has a much more posh British accent that comes from being a servant amongst the aristos of England.
Right? Amongst the wealthy.
I do like in this episode, we're still in the Penguin episode, Treacherous Waters. I do like how like manifestly false Bruce Wayne's Playboy routine comes across as. It comes across as a not very good routine that some people see through.
This is one of my favorite parts about this particular iteration of Bruce is that he's still trying to figure out how to balance this, but not in the terrible way that they did in the Batman film with dude from Twilight. That dude just comes off as like an emo punk. You would know he's Batman if you looked at him. I wonder which one of these guys is Batman. I don't know. Maybe the dude with the black eye makeup underneath his eyes.
I also loved how little Batman was in this first episode. And as a whole, you could honestly talk about how little Batman is in the show as a whole, which, again, I've seen morons on the internet complaining about, but that's good. It gives it a noir atmosphere. It makes it, when you actually do see Batman, it makes it cooler.
That's the whole point. That's how that works. The original, the 89 Batman movie, you don't see him as often as you do in the preceding films. That was one of the reasons that one was better.
I haven't seen a lot of interesting fan reaction to this. It's either they hate it or they love it, and then they tend to hate it for really stupid reasons. We'll get into the racism and the homophobia soon enough. But yeah, it's, I don't know who Golden Age Alfred is, or
we're Batman's little fins on his gloves.
The last thing I wanted to say, Matt, was I just really found that the giant cannon in the Iceberg Lounge charming. It felt very much like a Fleischer Superman cartoon or a Batman 66 plot or a Batman Night Comic plot. The giant cannon just really amused me.
The setting is so important to this show because it does feel like in the 40s. Somebody sitting on a yacht shooting at the police station with some cannon, a missile cannon.
Since I brought up the Fleischer Superman cartoon, I wasn't sure, Matt, I missed this when watching it. I guess I wasn't paying close enough attention. But I've seen the screen caps of a cameo from Lois Lane from the Fleischer Superman cartoons in the show. Was that the first episode, or was that another episode, or do you know?
I think it was the first episode, but I may be wrong. I don't know. I've seen the screen caps too.
And we were joking about this off air, and you said there was a Jimmy Olsen cameo, and I was, no, there isn't. It's just Lois. And then I went and looked at the picture, and no, you're right. Jimmy's there. He's in the second line, and a lot of his face is obscured by his camera, but you can still see the bright red hair. I'm a moron for not noticing. Last question about the Penguin episode from me. Was 5-year-old you stoked about the Batmobile and the Batsub?
Okay, the Bat Sub gave me Batman Forever vibes. You remember that thing Robin got to ride in?
I thought it was more of a bat.
No way.
You're thinking of the Penguin submarine from Batman 66.
Actually, Bob, it's much dorkier than that. You ready for this? The Bat Wing gets shot down and turns into
Batman Forever. Isn't there a scene in Batman Returns where he has some sort of bat boat that's like skimming on the water in the sewer?
Yeah, the Bat Ski Boat.
The Bat Ski Boat. Okay.
They can maneuver in the sewers.
You need a Bat Ski Boat for the sewers.
Bob, let me ask you this question, Bob. When you were younger, did you think the sewers were way bigger than they actually were?
Yes. And it's entirely because of superhero. It lies to you about the size of sewers.
Ninja Turtles, superheroes, Batman. Everybody. Yep. All these villains apparently live down there. And man, if you go in a sewer, it don't look like that.
Well, and also they make it seem like the sewers are mostly just like water, not full of garbage and feces.
Those Ninja Turtles are wading, skateboarding, and dookie.
We've got episode 2, Be a Villain, or as Matt might call it, the Clayface 1 episode.
Yep, this is the Clayface episode.
Clayface 1, as opposed to Clayface 2 from Batman the Animated. The first thing for me for this was we have Golden Age Rene Montoya, which is to say Rene Montoya, who I believe originates in Batman the Animated series, done in a very Golden Age style. Matt, do you think if we get enough seasons of Caped Crusader, we might see her become the Question?
Probably so. Man, she's built for it. She's got shoulders.
That'd be great. We already talked about Lucius Fox shows up in this. He's a lawyer. Did you want to add anything on that?
Have we ever seen him as anything else other than like a scientist or a Wayne Enterprise guy?
I wouldn't be surprised if he's a lawyer when he first shows up in the 70s, but I don't know. It also makes sense for... Given that you're going for this 1940s, 1950s thing, it makes sense that CEO isn't so much of an employment category for the 40s, right?
Right.
I mean, that obviously existed, but they weren't feted and celebrated and fetishized in the same way they are now. Then we have Clayface 1, Basil Carlo, working for Monoscopes Pictures, which is a reference to a studio called Monogram. That was like an extreme low-budget 1930s, 1940s movie studio in Hollywood. And they put out a lot of film noirs and gothic horror films. If anything, the Monoscope doesn't look as like Monogram is called Poverty Row Studio, I believe. It's some of the cheapest films you could make. Monoscope doesn't look quite that cheap. Matt, what did you think of the Golden Age Clayface design, which I didn't go back and look at the Golden Age comics, but I'm pretty sure it's pretty close to how he was in the Golden Age.
I got really heavy shadow vibes from him, especially when he's going from the fire escapes, jumping around Gotham and stuff.
He has the fedora and the scarf, right? And he has the laugh, which I was a little unsure if you want to, I mean, this is sounds like a dumb thing to say, but I don't know. Do you really want a villain to be so defined by laughing when you have the Joker, right?
Yeah, I do like that they kept the design more subtle than the animated series. He's not making axes out of his hands.
There's actually two different Clayfaces in some sense, right? Because the Golden Age Clayface is basically this guy. He's Basil Carlo. He's an actor. He can modify his face, but not much else. Honestly, I think even less than what we see Basil Carlo transform into in this episode. The Clayface who's in Batman the Animated Series is Matt Hagen.
Right.
And he's more a guy who goes into a cave and, if I'm remembering right, stumbles into a magical mud pool that gives him the ability to transform and gives him that more monster design of Clayface that we know from the animated series. But when they did the Clayface episode for the animated series, they did put in elements of the Golden Age Clayface because they had him be an actor struggling on a soap opera, I think it was.
Yeah.
So there's elements of both, but have Basil Carlo as Clayface here, and you have Matt Hagen as Clayface.
But they didn't have the magic cave or anything, Bob. They had that special cream or whatever he was making that was supposed to make him look younger.
You're exactly right.
Isn't that insane? Yeah. They combined it. It's weird. Magic cave origin stories, those are not the best.
Actually, there's two other clay faces that I don't know if they've ever been represented in cartoons. There's the Preston Payne clay face, who's the clay face who debuts in the late 70s.
Is that the one who looks like he wears like a robot looking suit or something? Yeah, he looks like Mr. Freeze.
He does look a lot like Mr. Freeze. I think it's he's in pain and his clay is hot and burning people or something. But I only read that first appearance that's, I think, was in the collection of the Steve Englehart, Marshall Rogers run on Batman, even though I think Englehart didn't write that. I think Lynn Wein wrote it. Then there's also a Lady Clayface, although I'm not sure when she comes around. But in the 90s, they had all four Clayfaces team up, and they call themselves the Mud Pack. To go back to the episode a little, the Batman Clayface sword duel on the castle set at the Monoscope Pictures, and I'm pretty sure that's straight out of the first Golden Age Clayface comic. I didn't have time to go back and reread any Golden Age Batman, but I think that's straight from the comic. I think I had the Batman Archive Volume 1,
that was
maybe the first 15 issues of Batman in Detective Comics or something like that, and I think that was in there. Did any of it get to you at all? We have the actor's corpse that has like a spider on its eye, and then we have that great scene where there's a fake corpse for Basil Carlo, and Batman pokes his finger into its face.
Yeah, Batman was having way too much fun shoving his hand into that thing's face. How deep is he going to put his finger in that man's cheek?
This is skipping ahead, but it's a motif they go to a couple times, right? Yeah. In the Papa Midnight episode with the Gentleman Ghost, Batman reaches into the Gentleman Ghost and it freezes his hand.
And
if you have the gloves, right, I guess you want to do things to highlight the glove.
You're not going to get this reference, Bob, but Deadpool 3, Cassandra Nova sticks her hand in people's heads. So lots of connections there in my brain.
That's funny. One small little detail I did want to note, the diner that Bullock and Flask go to in this episode is on Lark Avenue, and that's a reference to Michael Lark, most famously the artist for Gotham Central, the Gotham PD book that was out in the early aughts, and Baker and Rucka, who we mentioned before, the writer, not the only writers, but two of the primary writers for the show, they co-wrote Gotham Central with Lark on art.
Now we get into the next episode that I think probably should have been the first episode of the season, just to get new viewers acquainted.
It also would have been traditional, right? Because I think the Man-Bat was the first episode produced for the Batman the Animated Series, but I want to say the Catwoman two-parter with Catherine Janeway as the Red Claw was I think that was the first one that was actually aired of Batman the Animated Series. Episode 3, Kiss of Catwoman. Did you think the photographer Bill O'Brien might be Plastic Man?
Yeah, we're introduced to this photographer named Bill O'Brien, and I thought
Eel O'Brien is supposed to be a criminal, right?
Granted,
there's a lot of reimaginings in the show, so that's not necessarily dispositive. We start off with a display at the Gotham Museum, including the pearls that Martha Wayne was wearing on that fateful night in the finale. This is also why you're saying that this would have been a good first episode, because it does the Batman origin, but not in a tedious way.
You do learn and understand what goes on, just not as in your face.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And then we have some gawker being like, who the hell wears pearls like that in Crime Alley? What do you expect, lady? It's the East End. Which, I don't want to do some victim blaming, but that's kind of a valid point.
Yeah, this got the audible, like, oh, for me as I was watching it. I mean, I was glad to see his strength and he didn't just go out and punch that guy right in the face.
Yeah, and like you say, it is an interesting like crack in the Playboy Bruce Wayne persona.
But it is good that, you know, he does have, we're able to see that there are some consequences for those kind of actions for him.
So he becomes the patient of Dr. Harleen Quinzel. You often see them do this with a character like Harvey Dent, right? Where you play him out for a while before you make him Two-Face.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to see that done with Harley Quinn, too. It's interesting to see her deeply involved in the ongoing plots for a couple episodes before we reveal that she's a villain.
It's also interesting here that they went with Harley Quinn instead of Hugo Strange or Jonathan Crane.
Although we do have the mention that Jonathan Crane was Harleen Quinzel's teacher. If you're going to go with Batman goes to a villainous shrink, it's going to be Hugo Strange or Scarecrow. I also did think it was interesting that this show seems conscious that it's coming out right at the same time, within weeks of the Penguin TV series is supposed to start next month. And then I think the Joker 2 movie is also next month. One reason they did the gender-swapped Penguin and one reason they do a very different angle on Harley Quinn is that they just really want to differentiate these characters from how they're appearing in other media.
Well, they didn't quite do that, though, with the animated series and Batman Returns.
If I'm recalling correctly, they almost presented Batman the Animated Series as the cartoon version of Batman Returns. There were a lot of broad similarities between the appearance and the characterization of Penguin and Catwoman in Batman 92 versus Batman Returns that same year.
Riddler and Two-Face were so iconic from the animated series that they did not need to try to go back and revamp them when they did the new adventures.
Right. Although it would be interesting to go back and look and just see what, if anything, and I think you might be right that it was nothing, but what, if anything, the Batman animated series did with Riddler and Two-Face around Batman Forever or with Poison Ivy
and Bane, yeah.
All right, because actually the Bane episode for the animated series might have come out at around the same time as Batman and Robin, now that I think about it. I'm not sure about that, but it might have.
Yeah, I would be interested to see how the movies influenced the show, if they did at all.
Selina Kyle's initial apartment building is on Luton Place, and so that's a reference to a 1940s film producer named Val Luton. He's the producer, different directors, but he's the producer of a lot of really cool 1940s horror movies, black and white horror movies. I really love them, and the most famous of which is called Cat People.
Well, Bob, what do you think about the costume, Catwoman's costume, in this particular episode?
I thought it was really great, man. I mean, this is the classic 1950s, you know, got the cape, got the purple outfit. I dig it. The thing is, though, I just really didn't like this as a reimagining of Catwoman, though. In Batman Year One, which the show is drawing on pretty heavily for, they really established Catwoman as coming from nothing, right? Coming from real poverty. I like that angle for Catwoman a lot better than Catwoman as a spoiled rich girl. They really made her totally incompetent. I appreciate the necessity to do different things, right? But it wasn't to my taste. I don't find the Lady Penguin very appealing, but I'm not as bothered by it as I am bothered by making Catwoman incompetent.
Well, Bob, with Catwoman, I was okay with it for a couple of reasons. First off, there was a scene in her apartment where they made it very clear that she had had at least some like formal training. At least they try to explain some of how she's able to keep up with Batman. She collects cats, which we've seen kind of in some of the other shows, but in this, I like a Catwoman that is constantly taken in strays. Your cat's gone. What are you more upset about? We took your jewelry and we took your cat, which but I do agree with you too, though. The whole thing of her coming from wealth, I didn't mind that part so much, but I didn't like that she had a maid. I thought that was weird.
I actually did find some of the banter between her and her, I think, German maid pretty funny. And that does feel very much like a 1940s noir archetype of you have the femme fatale, and then you also have the vexed relation they have with their maid. One other thing I wanted to say about Catwoman, did you think they were kind of making fun of the costume too? Because I think there's at least two occasions where she trips on her heels.
Yeah, she trips on her heels a lot, which I thought was hilarious. As I was watching it, my wife was in the room. You ever think, have you ever tried running in hills like that?
You can, but you need a lot of experience, and probably it speaks to a certain profession, if you follow what I'm saying. But I'm saying, what I'm saying, folks, is that sex workers are good at running in heels, usually. At
Yes.
least, not all sex workers, but street walkers have to be good at running in heels. And I could be totally off base with this, but I almost wonder if the season two episode with Catwoman will be okay. Catwoman's back and she's serious now and she has a different costume without heels, right?
But Bob, she had the cat car.
The cat car is great, man.
You can't just go from having a cat car and the cool outfit to what outfit is she gonna wear?
I don't know, Matt. Maybe something closer to Batman Returns or Batman the Animated. I'm not saying I want them to do that. I'm saying they might be doing. Even though I didn't love Catwoman in this episode, I did love the bat desk, Matt. Batman having a desk rather than a bat computer really cracks me up.
This show threw me for a loop with that, Bob, because the when I was watching the commercials, you see Batman, he has that map of like Gotham streets, and they had made a point to say that this was set during this nondescript time where the technology's not insane. He legitimately has a map that he's working off of. I was like, whoa, old school Batman. With the phone, Bob, with the phone real quick. I was mad that he apparently the Batmobile has like Bluetooth capability. And Bob, this is why my brain it keeps trying to say like prequel. I'm having to beat it with a stick and be like, no, reptile, no. You don't have to, everything doesn't have to be connected.
Something else I wanted to ask. Do you think Caped Crusader was a good name for this series? I'm kind of leaning no. Caped Crusader is a good name for a Batman cartoon, but I think you should have reserved that for something that was a bit lighter, right? Whereas with this, I don't know. I mean, maybe they just should have called it Batman, and then I could trigger Matt by calling it Batman 24.
They should. I think they should rotate the names around, Bob.
Matt, the fourth episode is Night of the Hunters. And so that's a reference to a film from 1955 starring Robert Mitchum, Night of the Hunter. Have you ever seen that one?
I haven't, no.
You should really see that. It's great. Robert Mitchum he's a creepy preacher in a small southern town. Here, one of the things I thought was really interesting about this episode is that we're basically doing year one with the cops trying to hunt down Batman, doing fake muggings and
Yeah.
such, which is great. And then we have Renee Montoya doing the role of Sarah Essen, who later marries Gordon.
The entire sting operation was excellent. That's one of the best parts of the series, I think, so far. It's just watching him outsmart them.
Batman having a more adversarial relationship with the police, I think, is always pretty good, right? It's always nice to see Batman wail on some cops or outsmart some cops. We had a lot of small references in this one, too. We have a cop named Chandler, which I assume is a reference to Raymond Chandler. Do you know who that is?
He's a writer, right?
Yeah. He wrote the Philip Marlowe novels, and so one of the most important hard-boiled detective writers. And we actually meet Jim Corrigan as a cop, who we'll find out, spoilers, in a later episode is Dirty.
He is the Spectre, right, in DC.
He is the Spectre, right? And maybe I'll complain about that a little in that later episode. I've mentioned that Brubaker and Rucka, two of the main writers for this show, did Gotham Central with Michael Lark. And in Gotham Central, they introduce a Jim Corrigan character who's a dirty cop in that. Although I think in some versions, Corrigan's not a dirty cop. I think in some, he's just a too aggressive cop or just real hard charging. God gives him the chance to be the Spectre, and he takes it up because he hates evil that much, man. In Gotham Central, two of the important cops were Renee Montoya and Crispus Allen. And
Right.
they introduce Corrigan.
Right.
And it seems they're going to lead up to Corrigan being the Spectre, because that's what you would expect.
Correct.
But, and I might have the details on this wrong, because I haven't read Gotham Central since it was coming out. But if I'm remembering right, the end of Gotham Central swerves you, and Jim Corrigan kills Crispus Allen. Shortly thereafter, around the time of Infinite Crisis, Crispus Allen becomes the Spectre, and Renee Montoya becomes the Question.
Maybe we could see the Spectre next season. Maybe not.
We'll talk about this in a minute. It would certainly fit with the supernaturalism of the show,
Right.
right? So, Matt, we could have brought this up before, but I'm just bringing it up now. One of the things I was utterly shocked by, but in a good way, I think it's actually really cool, is that there's such a strong lesbian subtext in this series, especially you've got Barbara, you've got Harley, you've got Montoya, you've got Lady Penguin, and it's just, I really did not expect this to be like the 1940s lesbian noir show. It's awesome, man.
It's really interesting. It's some weird Sex in the City.
If anything, it made me kind of wish, we'll get to the reveal of Harley Quinn in the next episode. It actually made me wish they could have stretched out the Montoya, Harley, Barbara stuff a couple more episodes.
Yeah, that was actually entertaining. I enjoyed that. Just the whole... it's not even subtext though, Bob, really. I mean, it's all out there.
It's too strong to be subtext, but it still is a little understated. But it's great. Of course, some homophobes are big mad about it on Facebook. Who could have seen that coming? Rucka, one of the writers on this, is also the writer who started writing Montoya as a lesbian in the early 2000s. So who's our villain for this episode?
The villain of this episode, Bob, is a weird one. It's Firebug.
Do you know Firebug, Matt? I don't really know Firebug.
He was introduced in the late 70s. He just doesn't fly like Firefly does.
In this episode, he looks like Firefly, but without wings.
He just shoots flames.
There's been a couple Firebugs, but I think this is supposed to be the first one. Although, there's a third Firebug in the early 21st century, and this Firebug's costume sort of looks like the gritty early 21st century Firebug.
What's weird, Bob, is that this character actually appeared in the Batman NES game. No, it's not the character you think it is.
My first thought was, no, Matt, that's Firefly, because there's an early type of Joker henchman who flies around.
Yeah.
I don't think it's actually supposed to be Firefly, but you and I think, always thought of him as Firefly. Then, Matt, I had to do some reading, and so am I right in saying that the penultimate boss, it's like him, then Joker?
It's insane.
Do you really think I ever got far enough in that game to see Firebug?
Oh,
Matt?
Probably
like
not.
That's one of the hardest games ever made, and I'm one of the worst video game players ever made. How am I ever going to have seen Firebug?
Yeah, the only reason I made it through the game is through, like, you know,
Game Genie
and save states when I got older, being able to just save it and go back to meet it to right before I fell or whatever. But yeah, they have some strange enemies in that. They have the Electrocutioner.
Which, yeah, I was going to bring him up too, which is, I think in some sense is not so strange, because Executioner was pretty common in the late 80s Batman comics.
Then you've got KGB Beast.
Which I had no idea about. That's crazy. Yeah. I remember the Executioner because he's an early villain.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, I just thought he was a generic bad guy. I didn't realize he was actually a character.
They had a who's who. They can go with these random third string villains.
Do you want to run down the rest of the villains?
No, I don't have a. Could you pull up a list,
Matt? So I respect Wikipedia, right?
I don't want
to impugn the honesty of Wikipedia, but I do wonder about this list of villains from the Batman 1989 NES Sunsoft game. I mean, maybe it's right. I mean, I was just so incompetent at the game, I never got, I think, past the third level. But the list of characters or villains, according to Wikipedia for the game: Deadshot, KGB Beast, Maxi Zeus, Heatwave, Shakedown, Night Slayer, Killer Moth, an evil computer, the Executioner, a sort of other evil computer, Firebug, and the Joker.
Those aren't all bosses, though. Like, some of these are just characters you attack multiple times. You may remember Deadshot. Deadshot was in the first level. There was a dude that would shoot at you, and it was him. It was supposed to be Deadshot.
Oh, that was supposed to be Deadshot. And I am looking at a screen cap, and so Heatwave is just the guy with a flamethrower, which I just assumed was just a henchman with a flamethrower. What were KGB Beast and Maxi Zeus like? Do you remember?
Maxi Zeus, I want to say he was in the level that was like the sewer, the factory one, and he just shot lightning. It wasn't anything crazy.
KG Beast?
He's in the sewer level. He just jumps down at you and tries to hit you. He jumps off a ledge.
I have no idea who Shakedown is. I think I might broadly remember the Night Slayer. I think he has a sword.
A ninja guy, and he runs at you real fast.
He'll be relevant later. I might remember Killer Moth. I definitely remember the Executioner. I always had the theory that Firefly was one of the henchmen too, although the Wikipedia article is not validating that. Matt, should we move on to episode 5, aka the Harley Quinn episode?
Sure, Bob. So in episode 5, we finally do get to see Harley Quinn in costume.
Matt, you were more excited to see King Tut, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we do get to see other, you know, characters. It wasn't meant to be important necessarily, but we do get to see King Tut.
I don't think any of Harley's other prisoners that she has were supposed to be characters besides King Tut, at least as far as I could tell.
Yeah, I couldn't tell either, because I thought that we were going for something with that. There were so many different, each one had a different issue. One was like laughing like the Joker was getting tickled on the foot.
The title of this episode is Stress of Her Regard. That's a quotation from a poem by a guy named Clark Ashton Smith, who's not a very good poet, but he's a H.P. Lovecraft type guy. And it's about Medusa. And then there's a writer named Tim Powers, who I like, who I haven't read this novel by him, but he did a vampire novel called The Stress of Her Regard. And I happen to know from back in the day, I was a big Ed Brubaker fan, and Tim Powers is one of his favorite writers. So this is clearly a reference to that.
Okay, that makes sense. Going back to the King Tut thing, Bob, we've never seen King Tut outside of the 66 show, right?
He's shown up in the comics a couple times, both the mainline DC comics. You remember that Batman Confidential series that was Legends of the Dark Knight?
Yeah.
Rotating. There's a King Tut arc in that in the 2000s. Only other media appearance besides the 66 show. I think you're right, but I might be wrong.
Yeah, I didn't think that character was popular at all with anybody.
I've always thought King Tut would make a great serious villain. Maybe I'm being ridiculous. Yeah. I've always thought he would make a great serious villain. I've always, you know, a good King Tut story.
Well, I mean, what's going to be his motivation, Bob?
He wants to recreate his imperial power as a pharaoh, Matt. He's better than Maxi Zeus. You got to give him that at least.
I read an interesting take that some people think that Max Schreck in Batman Returns is meant to be Maxi Zeus.
Oh, that I can see that, actually, especially the emphasis on his skyscraper office.
He gets electrocuted at the end. He's all about the whole thing is about like building a power plant, remember?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I could totally see that. Thanks for telling me that. I do want Max Schreck to come back in some form. Like, Max Schreck was awesome. Right?
I like how when we were younger, we thought he might come back as Two-Face after he got shocked.
You were dumb kids.
Chris, I also thought Vicky Vale would become Batgirl.
Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm making myself sound better. I don't think I was that dumb.
That was just me. But looking at, I was like 4 years old watching Batman 1989. What do you expect?
I did have a personal trauma from this, Matt. Have you ever had a friend who always likes to role play? Not in bed, just in conversation, they like to role play.
Yeah, sometimes, yeah. Yeah, I've known people like that.
I hate that stuff. So when Dr. Harlan Quinzel was trying to get Montoya to role play, I was just like, oh my God, no.
Yeah, I don't have a friend who does that. I have a coworker who has the voice of Harley. That drives me insane.
We already talked about this a little, about the necessity of the show to like differentiate the Penguin from Colin Farrell and to differentiate this Harley Quinn from the Lady Gaga Harley Quinn in Joker 2. But what did you think of this as a Jokerless Harley Quinn?
I like it. She just gives her a gimmick of her own, even if it is a bit too Hugo Strange for my taste.
I hadn't thought about that, but you're right, especially Hugo Strange and that story, Batman Prey from Legends of the Dark Knight.
She's really brainwashing.
Is it just me being a communist? Or is it maybe not the best thing to have Batman defending billionaires? God forbid they donate their money to charity.
Yeah, I don't know what message you're trying to get across here.
I was a super fan of Brubaker and Rucka in the 2000s, and I followed them on social media back then. And I still like them, but my ardor has cooled somewhat. But I know from reading interviews and listening to interviews with them and following them on Twitter that they're both like big fat liberals, right? Not like physically, but just in terms of ideology. And they're trying to do good messages about economic inequality, I think, in this show. Like, there's the talk about unemployment leading to high crime. There's talk about deindustrialization in a different episode. And there's talk about inflation. Like, so they're trying to have a good kind of economic populist message, which I appreciate. But it just, I don't know. It just felt weird to be like, oh, yeah, Harley Quinn's robbing billionaires. Batman's got to defend his class. The last thing I wanted to ask about Harley Quinn, Matt, was do you remember Lockup from Batman the Animated Series?
Oh, yeah, I do remember Lockup. Yeah, he was originally created for that, right? For this.
Yeah. And then he shows up like maybe around No Man's Land.
He's the big vigilante prison guard.
He's the Arkham guard turned supervillain who's locking up supervillains. And so when you said Hugo Strange, I'm like, yeah, that's definitely an influence on this version of Harley, but also Lockup.
Oh, yeah, Lockup makes sense too.
And then, you know, so at the end, Montoya and Harley are supposed to meet at the Hoppers Jazz Club. Did you get that reference?
No, what is that a reference to?
Do you know that famous painting, Nighthawks, where it's like the cafe?
Yep.
That's Edward Hopper is the painting. The frame of the way the lines of the jazz club come out is the same as the building in the cafe in Nighthawks, the way the lines run. Episode 6, Night Ride.
Here's where we start to hit the supernatural, Bob. Gets a little more. We bust open that supernatural box.
Matt, do you know the Gentleman Ghost at all?
I do. I've seen renditions of him in several different things. I want to say he was in the
Brave and the Bold.
Did he make an appearance in Justice League Unlimited?
Probably.
But every character has been on that show.
Yeah. But, and traditionally, he's more of a Hawkman villain, but he was apparently often a Batman villain in the 70s, but we weren't really reading that.
You know? Right.
And it is a funny, I think usually the Gentleman Ghost is just a British highwayman ghost, but here they make him a Tory who opposed American independence and who hates the poor. Reverse Robin Hood. He robs from the poor, yeah. Which I thought was actually pretty hilarious.
He's just everything you should hate.
I was talking about the economic populism, class war themes, which are very prominent in this episode, too. I love Lucius Fox just calling Bruce Wayne out. I was raised to treat the staff like people, Bruce.
Bruce was raised by his butler, so I don't know. You would think he would act right.
We also learn in this that Harvey Dent comes from money, which is, I don't know if that's ever really been emphasized with Two-Face before, but it's an interesting character dimension, right?
Oh, yeah. They've never really pointed that.
There's a 1980s Batman annual. That's a Two-Face origin, and they really play up Harvey's dad beating him and flipping the coin to see if he's going to beat him. But I don't remember the economics of that, though. On a less grim note, we have a reference to the Moldoff coat of arms, and that's a reference to the 1950s Batman artist Shelley Moldoff, which was nice. And then, Matt, we get a character who I don't think I've ever seen in the context of Batman before. I mean, I know the character, but I've never seen him in a Batman context. It's Linton Midnight. Do you know Linton Midnight?
Yeah, that's Papa Midnight. He's like from Constantine. He's a voodoo consultant.
Yeah, voodoo consultant for John Constantine. I've mostly just been aware of him from the little Hellblazer I've read from the late 80s, early 90s. So, I mean, Matt, I think the controversy on this has somewhat cooled, but I remember when we were kids, it was controversial whether Batman should even be in stories with the supernatural. Do you have a take on that?
Well, it's because we wanted our Batman to be grounded.
Yeah, because we were dumb.
Yeah, and then we grew up a little bit. I'm okay with the supernatural stuff, just as long as it's in moderation. But it's like that with anything. I mean, you don't want too much supernatural crap, but
or too much grounded crap, or too much science fiction crap.
Right.
Yeah, you have some of each.
Everything in moderation.
Everything in moderation. Yeah, that I would agree with you on that. And I mean, I do think just like the theory is that Batman should be, or his villain should be, the scariest thing in a Batman story, not the devil. But I don't know. I think Batman's gothicness lends himself to good supernaturalism, and there's certainly stories, Grant Morrison's Gothic or Peter Milligan's story, Broken City, or no, Dark Knight, Dark City, excuse me. Broken City is Brian Azzarello and Eduardo Risso. But yeah, Dark Knight, Dark City, and Batman RIP and Gothic, I think are all good stories with the supernatural in them.
Yeah, it reminded me back when we were reading the comics and everything, I would pick up Strange Apparitions because it was supposed to be what inspired the screenplay for Batman 89. And reading the supernatural elements, how did this inspire that? But that was as a kid. Now I can see all the different nuances and different ways they pulled from the things. But at the same time, back then, I had no clue. So I thought it was so stupid.
Although, I think I liked them at the time.
You did.
Still think it's some of the best Batman comics ever done. And if I remember, I guess they did actually do the full-on ghost of Hugo Strange in that, don't they? Matt, on the point about good old King Tut, which we were talking about earlier, I'm in the Wikipedia page, so King Tut is in Batman the Brave and the Bold, but for copyright reasons, they call him the Pharaoh.
Oh, okay, the Pharaoh.
And I guess they also don't actually call King Tut King Tut in this episode. Do you know those two Batman 66 animated movies? I think it's Return of the Caped Crusaders and Batman vs. Two-Face.
The one with William Shatner's Two-Face.
Apparently King Tut is in both of those, as well as the Lego Batman movie.
Okay, wow. So he has made a couple of appearances outside of...
Yeah, and he's in Batman Unburied, that podcast that I have not listened to.
I knew he was in Lego Batman, but everything ever Batman was in Lego Batman.
All right, Matt. So back to Papa Midnight and the Night Ride and the Gentleman Ghost episode. So when Alfred's possessed by the Gentleman Ghost, he mentions a dark secret. Do you think that's something about the Waynes, or do you think that's something about Alfred, or maybe something about his lost daughter?
All right, Bob, it's going to be really controversial. You ready for it?
Hit me.
I bet money, Bob. It's that Dr. Wayne was really a criminal.
It would be fun if this show did a version of Batman RIP or of Tom King's Nightfall of the Heart, where you did have villainous Thomas Wayne. I could actually get behind that.
This has become that, but it's getting to the point where it's still, Bob, that's been done so many times. It's been done out. Yeah, but it's also been done in media beyond like what you, like the video game media, it's all over that. But
I'm fine with it, Matt, because rich people suck.
Yeah. We want to make sure we tie crime and wealth together. That way we feel better because we don't have wealth. We know they're committing crime to get it.
I think it's the Balzac line that every great fortune is built on a great crime.
That's actually probably true.
I do like in this episode, at the end, we have Batman returning a little bit of Gentleman Ghost in smoke form to Papa Midnight. And Gentleman Ghost is horrified. And I like to think that's in part because Gentleman Ghost, like so many Batman fans, is racist.
Well, Gentleman Ghost is a total racist.
Did I ever tell you that terrible story about the KKK and my ex-girlfriend working at the library?
I think you did, yeah, but tell it again because it's funny.
So I had an ex-girlfriend who worked at the library at University of Georgia, and there was an old lady there who she couldn't really do the work anymore, but they just let her go around finding books, and sometimes they would place books for her to find. And so she'd come around and she'd like inspect your cart when you were shelving looking for the books. And so she was looking for a book that had two K's in the call sign. And my ex-girlfriend just said jokingly, "Oh yeah, no KKK stuff here." To which the old lady is like, "Well, I never approved of hurting no one, but something had to be done."
There you have it. Those people still exist.
At least as of 5. Definitely still today. But yeah. Racist old bat. The last thing I wanted to say about the Gentleman Ghost episode is, maybe this was said before, but I didn't catch it till now, that Dent's aide was named Gorman. And that's probably a reference to a guy named Ed Gorman who writes noirs and westerns, although I've never actually read any of Ed Gorman's stuff.
Yeah, Bob's catching all these references that I have no clue to, so...
Or I'm just taking generic names and being like, that's also the name of a writer.
We trust you with that hard-hitting analysis.
Episode 7 is Moving Target. This is the onomatopoeia episode.
Ugh.
And it's named after a Lou Archer novel. Ross McDonald is the writer. Lou Archer is the PI. He's probably the second best hard-boiled detective after Raymond Chandler's Philip Marlowe, who we already mentioned. This is the first novel. It's actually the weakest novel in the series. Start somewhere else. But it's not a bad novel. And I know for a fact, just like I know Brubaker really likes Tim Powers, I know for a fact he really likes Ross McDonald. Matt, we start with Floyd Lawton taking a shot at what we think is Jim Gordon. Do you remember who Floyd Lawton is?
It's Will Smith.
Yes, you got it. It's Will Smith, also known as...
Deadshot.
Did this remind you at all of the Officer Down crossover from the early 2000s?
The entirety of this episode reminded me a little bit of Batman Arkham Origins, which has a whole plot where a hit has been put out on Batman, and all the assassins come to Gotham to take out Batman. That's the whole game.
Yeah, there's been some comic series like that too, although I can't think of specifics at the moment.
I was hoping they were going to take more from that game and bring in more assassins. When I saw that Deadshot was there, I was like, okay, cool. They're going to bring in other assassins, and then they just bring in Onomatopoeia and his like team of generic-looking assassins that all carry gun cases on trains.
Normal mob guys. I hate Onomatopoeia. He's a Kevin Smith creation, and I hate Kevin Smith. I think he first shows up in Kevin Smith's Green Arrow run, and then I think Kevin Smith does have him fight Batman. Yeah. This is still like a reimagined Onomatopoeia in some ways, making him much more of like a mob hitman rather than... I think the Kevin Smith version like kills vigilantes.
Correct.
But he still has the stupid gimmick of only speaking in onomatopoeia, which, you know, is just a stupid gimmick because you can't develop a character. It's just functionally a stupid concept.
Well, and they solved this by having his random henchmen speak for him, which is so lame.
He's got a couple of things. I will say, other than the presence of onomatopoeia, I didn't actually mind this episode that much. I thought it was pretty well done for the most part, at least until the end. But, and it was funny, my boy Noah, when he saw onomatopoeia in the trailer for the show, he's, I might not watch the show. He hates onomatopoeia. He, in fairness to him, he also hates J.J. Abrams, who's a producer.
Yeah.
So I encouraged him, look, onomatopoeia is one of the worst parts of the show, but it's not that bad, and it's only one episode.
You know, I used to like Green Arrow Quiver. I haven't read it in 15 years, probably.
I liked it, too. I didn't really, like, come to hate Kevin Smith until he started doing awful comic with Black Cat, mm-hmm. or the awful comic where Silver St. Cloud says that Batman gave her 30 orgasms in one night or something.
The one where Batman pisses himself.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I was already off the train by that point. Kevin Smith sucks, people. A few other references in this. So they're talking about a middleman named Mueller. That might be a reference to a guy named Eddie Mueller, who's a historian of film noir and is prominent on Turner Classic Movies. We have a crooked screw or a crooked prison guard named O'Hara, which I choose to believe is this universe's version of Police Chief O'Hara.
Yeah.
In 66.
I forgot about him.
And then there's a reference to Cross Street's Wheeler and Nicholson, and that's a reference to a guy named Malcolm Wheeler Nicholson, who was a colonial army officer who started the company that later becomes DC. Matt, are you ready for the thing that really enraged me about this episode?
What enraged you about this episode the most, Bob?
Well, it's two things. So I thought it was, despite onomatopoeia, I thought it was fine enough. But then at the climax, we have, you know, we find out really the hit was on Barbara Gordon, not Jim Gordon. And Corrigan is about to kill Barbara. And so Gordon bursts in. He shoots Corrigan's hand, so he drops the gun, which I think, I hate that stuff. You can't shoot like that. Nobody actually shoots like that. You aim for the center of the target.
Yeah.
You can't shoot a hand or a foot. That's stupid. You shouldn't do it. So that sucks. It also sucks, like, why wouldn't you just have Gordon kill Corrigan so he can become the Spectre? Like, that's much cooler. You don't have to do him becoming the Spectre this episode or even ever, but just him killing Corrigan would be much cooler, I think. Do you agree?
Okay, I do agree with that, because then you could have some interaction with the Spectre and Gordon in season two or three or whenever this...
Even if you never get to it, even if it's just Gordon kills Corrigan and it's a loose end where he can become the Spectre.
Yeah.
The other thing I hated was the entire episode was somewhat structured around an argument between Jim and Barbara about how much do criminals deserve a fair trial or whatever.
Right.
And the structure of the episode just seemed to be there to vindicate, no, Jim is right. Barbara's a bad person. Criminals don't need competent legal defense, Matt. They're just bad people.
There's some weird messages coming through, Bob, in the show, I have to say.
Yeah.
That's definitely one of them.
Episode 8, Nocturne, which is the Nocturna episode, although I didn't know that for quite a while.
Yeah.
But Matt, do you know what a nocturne is?
Is it like a work of art inspired by the night?
You got it, Matt. You got it. Oftentimes a piano song is like solo song, but not just. It can be like a poem or something else, too.
Well, Bob, we do get a look at Julie Madison here.
Would you agree that she's the Selena Kyle we have at home, Matt?
Yeah, definitely the Timu version of Selena Kyle.
Yeah, very much so. So when we first meet Nocturna, she looks like Wednesday Addams. And so Nocturna and her brother, the Night Slayer, they're from early 80s comics that I don't think either of us have ever really read. But when we first see Nocturna, she looks like Wednesday Addams. And I was thinking she was either Zatanna or maybe they gender swapped Clarion the Witch Boy into Clarion the Witch Girl. Matt is the world's biggest fan of Clarion the Witch Boy, as you would know if you listened to our Young Justice coverage on patreon.com/uncannytracks.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of Clarion the Witch Boy. I cannot stand the magic he brings forth. This character, I didn't know what she is. She's supposed to be a vampire? I mean,
I think she's, again, I've never really read the comics, but I think she's basically a vampire in the comics.
She seemed like the most child-safe vampire they could put on TV. She would have been a great character in the 92 animated series because they wouldn't have had to... She doesn't bite you. She just sucks your life force out of your mouth.
Sucks your soul force. And yeah, she has enough control that she doesn't have to kill you.
Right.
I did think it was funny that apparently when she's there in the early 80s, a large part of her presence in this comics is she and Batman are arguing over custody of pre-crisis Jason Todd. And so that's kind of funny that in this version, she's a lot younger, but she's still like menacing Jason.
Yeah, we get all the Robins, Bob. All of them.
At first, we get Dickie Grayson, Jace Todd, and Steffi Brown. And I wrote the question in the notes, Matt, do you suppose we're also going to see in this episode Cass Kane, Dookie Thomas, Tim Drake, and Carrie Kelly? And then lo and behold, Carrie Kelly actually shows up.
Carrie Kelly showed up. She sure did, with her slingshot in hand.
With the slingshot. And she saves Batman with her slingshot. That was great, because you really don't see Carrie Kelly in that much stuff.
They made sure they did the correct. All the characters had the kids all looked at their part. You had Jason Todd with the red hair, which was neat. You had Stephanie was...
Pre-crisis, Jason Todd has red hair. Post-crisis has black hair. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. Yes. And then Stephanie, when they were described, they said she was missing and they described her as having a blonde ponytail. Stephanie, yeah. We've seen before.
Well, they also did a good job of distinguishing the personalities, right? Because it's four kids, but they're not interchangeable, which you might fear they might be.
Yeah, I could totally watch a show like this, kind of like Rugrats or something. Yeah. Like, these four Robins in the foster care.
I don't think the show is ever going to go there, but it might not work. But I would really be interested in seeing them all become Robin at the same time.
A Robin team, a team of Robins, yeah. A squad.
Like the Ultimate Spider-Man comics had all the Spider-Man villains produced by one lab explosion. It elegantly, like, Batman can just get all of his sidekicks from Leslie Tompkins' orphanage, right? He doesn't have to keep finding separate.
What if Leslie Tompkins just... What if he has a tournament at his orphanage to determine who his partner will be? And there's, like, rankings and stuff. I mean, I think it'd be pretty cool.
Yeah. A couple other things about this episode, Matt. I did want to ask, so did you have any theories about who Wednesday Adams / Nocturna was when she first showed up?
I had no clue, Bob. I thought she may have just been created for this. Her design reminded me of the character in that final, the episode that was meant to be for Batman Beyond. The girl who, at the very beginning, Batman swings with her mind. She could destroy things with her mind. You know what I'm talking about?
Are you sure that's the end of Batman?
Not the end of Batman Beyond. It was meant to be the epilogue. It was a Justice League Unlimited cartoon.
We already talked about him a little in a prior episode, but we have Dr. Knight, who's Nocturna's brother, who at first I was thinking was Ted Knight, the Golden Age Starman, who he does sort of look like. But no, it's Anton Knight, who is the villain called the Night Slayer in the early 80s and is Nocturna's brother. He's a henchman in Batman 89, the game.
Deep cuts here, man.
Then this cut I don't think is as deep, Matt. We got a Waylon Jones as a part of the circus or the carnival.
We got Killer Croc there, Bob.
Another 80s character, too. Interesting. Carrie Kelly, Waylon Jones, Nocturna, Night Slayer, all these 80s characters in this episode. And then one small reference is we have Matt Milligan as a character here, who might be a reference to Peter Milligan, who wrote Dark Knight, Dark City, one of the best Batman stories. And then also, this is me just being a little persnickety, but there's a lot of talk about Harvey Dent's polling in this show. Mm-hmm. And I just want to point out that, like, I've worked in city politics. City polls are both unreliable and hard to do and therefore expensive. And so you don't really poll city races that often.
But Bob, have you ever worked the polls in Gotham City?
Given how crooked Gotham is, you just make it all up.
Yeah.
All right, Matt. So we got a two-part finale. They're called The Killer Inside Me and Savage Night. I've been mentioning a lot of references, but the two I really want to stress, you should really watch Night of the Hunter. Mm-hmm. That's a great movie. And you should really read either or both The Killer Inside Me or Savage Night. They're both Jim Thompson novels. They're very short. They're both less than 200 pages. They're really nasty, brutal noirs. I love them a lot. And so I just really want to give a PSA for the listeners. Read Jim Thompson, watch Night of the Hunter.
This is a retelling of Two-Face's origin,
which was also a two-parter in the animated series, I think.
Correct. Comparatively, Bob. Batgirl. Yeah, it did have Batgirl. Comparatively, does this hold up to the other one?
I would say I think I haven't rewatched the Two-Face two-parter from Batman the Animated Series in years. In my memories, it's better, But I do think this is a really valid and really interesting version, and I'm glad that, even though I don't think it's as good as the original, I really like it. I'm glad they did it. Does that make sense?
It does make sense, yeah. And I'd say I did enjoy this version, but I think the original from the original anime series, I think it's still in my brain is
one of the only good fan things I saw online that actually did make me think about the show in a different way was. I hadn't really tracked this as close as I should have, probably because I was tired after, not as tired as Matt, but I was tired after having seen so much Batman, is they did a good job in this of whenever Two-Face is saying something messed up, it's the scarred face.
Correct, yeah.
But here it's the Harvey Dent face,
mm-hmm.
which I think is a really neat inversion that it like makes the Harvey Dent side of him actually the crappy side in a way.
Well, yeah, and they messed up the opposite side of his face than what they usually do.
Than usual.
Which is different. It's throwing me off.
Do you remember that series that was coming out at the same time as Hush in Detective Comics called Dead Reckoning?
Yes.
It was basically what if Hush were good,
mm-hmm.
and it was also what if Hush was 6 parts instead of 12 parts. So Brubaker, the main writer on this, wrote that. And do you remember who the villain in that the Hush we have at home that's actually better than the Hush at the drive-thru was?
You'll have to remind me, Bob.
It's the other Two-Face, sometimes I think called False Faith, who's the actor. I think his name is Paul Sloan. We saw him in a cameo in a Young Justice comic not too long ago. But yeah, I wonder, maybe they won't go there, but I wonder if since they did the wrong face for this Two-Face, if they get a season 2 or 3, they might do a story with False Face where he has the more typical scarring and maybe do something with that. That might be cool.
That would be interesting. A different take on it, at least. Also, they didn't go for the gross out factor or anything at all either. Even though his face is scarred just with the way the design is,
yeah,
it's not enough to be too nasty to look at, but it's still way more horrifying looking than it was in the animated series.
I also really liked the design of him with half his face bandaged going out to the club with Bruce. It's really visually cool.
That was cool.
They had the two-headed coin, right, which they set up, I think, in the first episode.
Right, yeah, yeah.
It was just funny that they kept the coin, but they did something a little different with it. I thought that was neat.
Yeah, it was so much like The Dark Knight, though, in that sense. Because
they do that in the
That was a big thing with Rachel Dawes, yeah.
Interesting. Do they do that same thing with it's a two-headed coin, or no?
He says, I make my own luck. But it's because he has a two-headed coin.
Oh, I totally forgot that. Okay. Thanks for reminding me of that. A few other little details about this. In the first part of The Killer Inside Me, you have like Two-Face lying prone on the sofa. And you have his big, big, you know, home entertainment technology that I just assumed was a radio. Why did he bother to track the radio right next to his couch? And then it turned out to be a TV. And I thought that was funny. Then we have Matthew Thorne is Boss Thorne, Rupert Thorne's son here. I think in some comics, Rupert Thorne does have a son named Philip, although I can't say that I've ever actually read a comic with Philip in it. But Matthew Thorne is often the name of the crime doctor. Do you remember that villain?
I do remember the crime doctor. That's who you get taken to if you get shot at and can't go to an actual hospital.
And in some versions, including, I think, the animated series, the crime doctor is Rupert Thorne's brother.
Here's what's interesting, Bob. People may not know this, but Dr. Thomas Wayne is actually the original crime doctor.
I'd be down with that.
That's a little secret.
Well, and I should have brought this up, too. So in Brubaker's Batman run, right before Hush and before the Detective Comics thing with Paul Sloan, do you remember in the Greatest Batman Stories Ever Told collection, there was a story about like the mobster who hired Joe Chill to get revenge on Thomas Wayne for wearing the Batman costume?
Yes.
At the costume ball? Yeah, so Brubaker brought Lou Moxton like into the 2000s Batman, and so it is kind of interesting that he might be going that direction again with this too.
That'll be really good if we see this.
Yeah. I remember I didn't like the Lou Moxton Joe Chill stuff when I was a kid, but I think I've come to appreciate it more.
It'll be interesting to see what they do with it here if that's the direction they do decide to go in.
Did you catch what might have been a Professor Pig cameo?
I actually missed this completely. I didn't see anything like a Professor Pig.
Do you remember when he's in, I can't remember if it's Arkham or just the hospital, but Harvey hands a pig doll to an inmate? we've got the very iconic image of Batman holding a gun in the climax of Savage Night, which I thought was pretty cool and pretty well handled. But it, yeah, it seems like at least some people are not pleased with it. I was kind of wondering where you came down on it.
Oh, Batman holding a gun is always cool. It's a rare scene, and when you do see it, you know that either he shot someone or you're going to see something pretty badass, which having the bullets surrounding Flask.
As soon as he fired the second shot, I mean, I didn't think they were going to actually have Batman shoot Flask, but as soon as they fired the second shot, I was like, oh, I know exactly what he's doing. But it was still a cool scene to then, you know, cut to Flask being surrounded by bullet holes. I've never been so precious. I'm actually okay with Batman having a gun and okay with Batman killing. I think that might be because I had a copy of the Batman archives at a relatively young age, and those greatest Batman stories ever told where he does kill.
Right.
I get why people don't want it to happen. And I definitely, my least favorite type of story is, oh, we have to do an elaborate justification of why Batman doesn't kill the Joker. No, that's stupid. Just don't mention it. But that said, I also don't mind having an alternate version where Batman kills or where he uses a gun. Well, Matt, so the other controversial thing, which if the people who hate, you know, who hate having characters of color and who hate having lesbian characters, if they ever make it to the end of the show, I assume they're going to be Donald Trump fans, and I assume they're going to be very, very angry by the end of the show. Do you follow what I'm saying?
No, but you need to reiterate, Bob.
So at the end, we have Batman pull what I can only describe as a Thomas Michael Crooks on Boss Thorne as he stands on a roof and throws a batarang very precisely to cut Boss Thorne's ear, which obviously this was made long before the failed Trump assassination attempt, but coming out just a month after, it's hilarious to me. It's really funny.
Yeah, it's insane. Like, I don't know what, if they had some crystal ball of the future or what, but man, that couldn't have been like telegraphed more precisely.
Yeah, and I'm really glad they didn't. I'm really glad they didn't change it.
Yeah,
and I almost wonder if they did change anything about it, if this is the toned down version. I think probably they just didn't change it, because I think you can argue, since it's a batarang rather than a bullet, it's different.
Right.
But especially, and there's kind of a 1-2 punch effect too of having Batman had the gun just in the prior scene, right?
Right. So yeah, it's crazy how it lined up. But
oh yeah, I thought it was hysterical. I was really happy. I texted a lot of people very excitedly about it. I almost wish they could have just ended on that, right? Like that image of Batman standing on the rooftop after having thrown the batarang at Boss Thorne with the lightning behind him, which looks very similar to an important image from Batman the Animated Series. I thought that would have been a fine place to cut it, but
no, Bob. You know, we have to have the Joker. We have to.
It's traditional. You always have to have a Joker teaser, and they are imitating Year One, right? Which also ends with a Joker teaser.
Which was imitated by Batman Begins.
Which was imitated by Batman Begins. Although I did think that they did a good job of focusing on the victims of Joker Venom rather than the Joker himself. Does that make sense?
That is true. Yeah, we didn't have to actually see him.
And then this is, I want to preface this by saying, I know it's a way too early to judge. And again, I salute the show being willing to do reimaginings. I think that's good. I think it helps keep the characters vital to see them in different forms. It did seem, and tell me if you disagree with this, but it did seem the little teaser of the face and the voice of the Joker we got, I didn't really like it. They were playing him more as like a mad scientist and less as an insane guy. Did you get that same vibe?
Why was his voice so deep?
Yeah.
It wasn't playful.
Yeah, it wasn't playful at all. And it also kind of put in context, we were a little bit commenting on the Clayface having the shadow or the Joker type laugh. Well, I guess you can give it to him if the Joker's not going there.
For them to choose a voice actor who sounds so much like Kevin Conroy, in my opinion, and then to go like completely weird choice here with the Joker.
I'm willing to be impressed or surprised with what they do.
Yeah, I'm interested to see what direction they do go. But see, now we're stuck with this thing, at least I am, Bob, because at the end of The Batman, there was a Joker reveal.
Oh, wow.
And now here we have another Joker reveal at the end of Caped Crusader. It's just like, come on.
So it's year one, Batman Begins, you know, Batman and Caped Crusader all do it.
Yes. It's like, okay, it's the Joker. All right. We gotcha. Yeah.
Well, Matt, I think that was the end of like the episode by episode stuff, and we thank the listeners for sticking with us for this longest ever Uncanny Treks episode.
Now I got nothing to watch.
You got X-Men to watch for next week?
Oh, yeah, I guess I should go watch X-Men.
All right. So I did want to ask before we got into our categories, Matt, did you see any interesting fan response on this? Somebody caught the Lois Lane cameo for me, and somebody made the point about the Two-Face portrayal. But other than that, it's basically just I've seen a lot of salty racist. I've seen a lot of morons saying My Adventures with Superman is much better than this, which makes me sad.
I haven't seen a ton of response, honestly, and I'm thinking not a lot of people have watched it up to this point.
Well, it is number one on Amazon, though. I mean, whatever that means. It displaced The Boys.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Matt, of the reimaginings, who is your favorite reimagining?
I really like what they did with Clayface. I just like this version of Clayface.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with you. It's a great version of Clayface. If one wanted to be a pedant, one could say it's pretty much just Golden Age Clayface. Is not a reimagining,
but right?
Compared to the Matt Hagen, like, magical cave Clayface,
yeah,
we sort of get in Batman the Animated Series. I'm gonna go with Harley Quinn. I actually like this version of Harley a lot. It's cool.
Yeah, I was a little nervous when I first saw the commercials and the trailers and stuff, but this it turned out great.
Yeah, and then your least favorite reimagining?
Yeah, I'm gonna go with the Penguin, but not because she's gender swapped, just because it just didn't land well. The entirety of it.
Yeah, I didn't like Lady Penguin, although like you, I'm not opposed to gender swaps in theory. I think you just have to judge it on a case by case basis. But I appreciate that they went for it, and like you were saying, it was an odd but perhaps intentional choice to lead with that.
I think more time with that character would probably make her more interesting to me.
I am interested to see where they go with her. And I'll tell you, as soon as her sons showed up in that episode, I should have said this in her episode coverage, I assumed that one of them was going to be England. And then they very much didn't go that direction, it was almost like they wanted to tease you into thinking that's what they were going to do, and then they did.
Right, yeah.
I agree with you that I don't like Lady Penguin, but I'll go with Catwoman. I just can't, even though there was a lot to like about this Catwoman, I just can't deal with an incompetent Catwoman. That's not right.
Well, Bob, my favorite episode was Stress of Her Regard, which is the Harley Quinn episode.
Yeah, yeah.
These titles need to have villain names in them.
I could go with pretty much any of them. Asshole. I mean, I honestly thought most of these were great. I would be fine saying that any was my favorite. The one exception to that would be, and I didn't utterly hate this episode, I would still probably put it in good rather than dumpster fire, even though a lot about it made me angry. But my least favorite was Moving Target.
Mine too. Yeah, anything with the onomatopoeia thing. I feel like they could have entered. I really was expecting to see more assassins, I guess. I think in my mind I had this different picture of what I expected from an episode where you're bringing in lots of assassins to murder someone.
Yeah.
With so many different characters to choose from. And you tease us with Deadshot at the beginning. I mean, come on.
Yeah. And that is wild to, like, you dispose of Onomatopoeia because he's a one-gag character, and then you do Deadshot.
Yeah.
not vice versa. I agree with you that you could do a lot with the assassins thing. Like, they've done a good episode of Batman Beyond with that, for example. But I do kind of appreciate that they are trying to do a mob aesthetic for the show. I just wish they'd done it with a better character than Onomatopoeia.
I'm gonna think on that one and try to come up with a better character that could have been there.
In a KGB Beast?
Yeah. That...
I actually am really interested to see if they do KGB Beast for this. That you could do something cool with that.
Definitely.
I usually don't like KGB Beast, but I think you could do something cool. All right, Matt, do you want to run me through your rankings of American superhero cartoons?
Sure, Bob. So you asked me to rank these, and then I looked at your ranking, and I was like, this is pretty much spot on, Bob. I don't have...
Oh, I wanted to just have you present it to yours, and then I'd be like, I agree with you, Matt.
Okay, all right. So Bob, if I had to rank the U.S. superhero cartoons that I've seen, I would say Batman 92, Batman Beyond, that whole thing.
And we were talking about this off air, but yeah, I think those are functionally the same show.
They are, yeah, pretty much. X-Men 92, X-Men 97 will be number two. And you need to check out our coverage on 97.
Free.
free, yeah. And then our X-Men 92 coverage is on Patreon. Yes. The third Bob in my rankings, I would put this show.
Are we being too premature putting it here just based off one season, Matt?
Based off one season, Bob, and knowing what I know about Young Justice in its current season and the fourth season, I'm okay putting it number three, Bob, because honestly, I'm treating it like a prequel to Batman 92.
Yeah, one could argue maybe we should just put it Batman 92, Batman Beyond, Cape Crusader, all as one thing, right?
Because then I'm like, well, then Justice League and JLU should also be in that same, like, the whole Timverse thing, so.
Yeah, but to me, I guess they're definitely the same universe, a lot of the same characters, but to me, the aesthetic identity between Batman 92, Batman Beyond, and Cape Crusader is so strong.
Mm.
I'm kind of thinking that instead. Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily fold JLU or the Superman 96 show into that. You see what I'm saying?
Right, because it's a different aesthetic. You're right, yeah. So you had Cape Crusader number three, then number four we have Young Justice, which, you know, I'm loving Young Justice. It's a good show. Justice League Unlimited. Yeah, I could see that after Young Justice, so that would be number five.
Yeah, my argument for that would just be Young Justice does more interesting things narratively than Justice League Unlimited, even though I like both a lot, and I think both are tremendous shows.
Yeah, and Young Justice does, like, the big-time, like, events really well. Some of that was just...
Yeah.
Spidey 94, you guys, number six. Yes, I agree with that. With Superman 96 after that at number seven. Legion of Superheroes number eight is fantastic. That's a good show. I haven't really seen much of Static Shock, but I would definitely put it somewhere around there, I guess.
I would say the highs of Static Shock, I mean, honestly, might put it at number six. But there are some real bad lows of Static Shock. Usually only once or twice a season, there's just an episode that is so cringy. In the fourth season, there's an episode that's supposed to set up a spinoff of Static teams up with NBA players who have Iron Man suits.
That sounds awesome. All right. So number 10, Bob, we got Silver Surfer. I've watched some of that. Man, that show, if you watch that show like inebriated or anything, it's not that bad.
Yeah, it's great. It's worth your time. It's only one season, so it's, you know, yeah, very manageable.
Yeah,
the only downer is it ends on a cliffhanger.
Yeah. Now, you left off Fantastic Four, Iron Man.
Well, because Iron Man is terrible, and honestly, the Fantastic Four show is terrible, too. Yeah. I like it more than the Iron Man show.
You left off Earth's Mightiest Heroes.
I haven't seen all of Earth's Mightiest Heroes, although I hear great things. I had, once I actually rewatched, or actually, I think Cape Crusader displaced Gargoyles, which I had on here.
Oh, okay. I said last time we did this list, I know you had a couple more. So, yeah, Bob, I'm in agreement with this. This is good.
And then one last question, Matt, before we round out this epic length episode. So, yeah, I said a lot of people were negatively comparing this to My Adventures with Superman, which is insane to me. Do you think that it would have been better if they'd done, because originally Cape Crusader and Superman My Adventures with Superman were announced together, right?
Right.
Do you think if My Adventures with Superman had been this 40s and 50s style, I mean, certainly we would have liked it more, but do you think that would have been better? Or do you think that this area for Superman has already been well trod with the Fleischer cartoons and even to some extent the 1996 Superman cartoon?
The look and setting and everything they went for the My Adventures with Superman cartoon is definitely the direction they should have gone because of all the technology stuff. And it wouldn't have fit. I don't think the aesthetic would fit very well with some of the stuff they're trying to pull off.
But I'm just saying they should have just done... Basically, I'm saying they should have done a wholly different show that was while Superman specific was more like this than the manga and, you know, the anime and the technology. But on the other hand, I don't think it'll do this, but if My Adventures with Superman is what you need to get, like, Zoomers and Generation Alpha who are, you know, have anime, it's natural to them. If that makes Superman accessible to them and we get a bunch of new Superman fans out of it, I mean, even though it's not for me, I can say it did a good thing, right?
Right, Bob. That's a good way to put it. And I don't think Batman, I don't think this Cape Crusader show is going to have as big of a, I hate to say it, but I don't think it's going to have even as big of an impact as the Superman show.
Oh, I strongly disagree. I think
you think so?
Batman... I think Batman pretty much, I mean, say this with some chagrin because I really, really like Superman, but I think Batman pretty much always outperforms Superman. If we believe Amazon, and you should always be skeptical about this rankings.
Yeah, that's the
only... If we believe Amazon, a comparable number of people who watch The Boys are watching this. I don't think a comparable number of people who watch The Boys are watching My Adventures with Superman.
Yeah, we're going to do some research, Bob, because I would like to know, honestly.
As far as I know, you can't know because the streamers like to keep that stuff very confidential.
Because I'm just thinking, man, because I have not had... There's been very little interaction about the Caped Crusader, like, in any kind of stuff. I look over and then...
Yeah. But it's also, I don't know, it's only been out for 3 days. Sorry, one more question. Are you a little annoyed that they dropped it all at once? I'm a little annoyed.
I am. I would have loved to have done a week-by-week thing with it. Cause...
We would have had so much fun with that.
Yeah.
I mean, it wouldn't have, you know, maybe some listeners, well, you could have done it anyway, but it wouldn't have been the same. There would have been value to covering it week to week.
Well, no, and people are used to binging things. So the consumer is actually going to be probably end up binging at least two or three episodes. Yeah. A night, whereas if we did it week to week like that, they're not going to keep up with it.
And then the other thing that's interesting, I can't decide, like, on the one hand, the standalone nature of these episodes would have been great week to week, but in another interesting way, it actually does make binging it pretty bearable, right? When you binge your usual Prime or Netflix show and it's heavily serialized, there's a sense that it just all lumps together. Mm-hmm. And you can't really differentiate episodes. They don't have distinct... And this, and you binged it stronger than I did. You could probably speak to this, but like it does give it a differentiated identity in a nice way, I think.
Oh, it totally does. I mean, because I'm able to remember, okay, that was the episode where he took on this character, or this just having a different villain each episode, and the way it's been set up with very distinct plots. I can see where there's the pros and cons to binging a show. I mean, we've talked about this before with all the other stuff we've done. It's just, in this case, though, I think for our listeners, it's better that we went ahead and covered the entire season in one episode here.
Well, it's been a real pleasure talking about Caped Crusader with you, Matt. I wish in the alternate universe we could have done it week to week. But yeah, join us next week. We'll probably be back with some Fantastic Four coverage before too long. We'll probably be back with some Star Trek, the animated series coverage as prelude to Lower Decks. And if the Penguin show is good, we might do week-to-week coverage of it. We'll just have to see if it's good.
I've got a feeling it's going to be pretty good, Bob. We'll be covering the Penguin.
I liked that trailer, although your brother did call me a sicko for liking it. Well, this has been Uncanny Treks on Caped Crusader Season 1, epic length binge episode. I'm Bob in Cascadia. That's Matt in the Southland. Have a great night, everybody.
Thanks for listening.